and Answers begins right now.
You've heard of terms like woke, social justice, white privilege, and other related terms regarding to the problem of racism. All these terms are related to contemporary critical theory. You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. During our time together today, Pat and his guests, Dr. Neil Shenvey and Dr. Pat Sawyer, will be discussing critical theory and how it has impacted the culture and the church. Now, with part one of this three-part interview, is our host, Pat.
You're listening to Evidence and Answers, where we provide compelling evidence for faith and hope in Christ and biblical answers to the issues of today. Well, you've heard a lot of terms like woke or wokeness, social justice, critical theory, critical race theory, queer theory, white privilege, and other related terms regarding the problem of racism. Well, all these terms are related to what's called contemporary critical theory. What is contemporary critical theory? How has it impacted our culture and the church? Well, here to help us understand contemporary critical theory, one of the prominent ideologies of our culture today, is Dr. Neil Shenvey and Dr. Pat Sawyer. Dr. Shenvey earned his PhD in theoretical chemistry from UC Berkeley. He is an author of several books, including Why Believe? A Reasoned Approach to Christianity, and is widely recognized for his writing on critical theory. Dr. Pat Sawyer earned his PhD in Educational Studies from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, where he serves as a professor there as well. He is a well-published author and a noted speaker. So, gentlemen, welcome to Evidence and Answers.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, let's begin with you, Dr. Shenvey, and just give us a brief overview of what do you mean by critical theory, or as you place it in your book. By the way, they've got a great book on this subject here, Critical Dilemma. Outstanding book. I'm making my way through it. So they've written a lot on this topic. But what do we mean, Dr. Shenvey, when we say critical social theory or critical theory?
Good question. So critical theory today is an umbrella category that encompasses many different critical social theories, including critical race theory, queer theory, critical pedagogy, intersectional feminism, and a host of other theories. What all of these theories share is a concern about power. How does power operate within culture to produce oppressed groups and oppressor groups? So this tradition goes back basically to Karl Marx and evolved over the next several hundred years through the Frankfurt School, people like Antonio Gramsci, the postmodern philosophers like Foucault and Derrida. And today what we have is an amalgamation of postmodern thought, of Marxist thought, neo-Marxist thought, of feminism, and a host of other contributing factors. So we've termed these ideas that suffuse our culture using the label contemporary critical theory. And we've identified sort of four big ideas that underpin all of these critical social theories today. And in our book, we talk about how these ideas, the social binary, hegemonic power, lived experience, and social justice are deeply affecting the way that people view reality and are even influencing Christian theology.
Dr. Sawyer, you want to add to that?
Well, I would just mention that, you know, critical theory has various iterations of itself since beginning with Marx and going into the Frankfurt School in the 1920s and 30s, and then now critical social theory, this umbrella term for a range of critical theories that Neil mentioned, like critical pedagogy, critical race theory, postcolonialism, and queer theory, and so forth. We want to keep in mind that critical theory is about power. It is about assessing power in society, who has it, who doesn't have it, and why. And it's looking at power manifested not so much on the individual level, but in terms of our institutions, our social systems, and in society. And so it's trying to tease out who has power and how that power is manifested in these social systems to benefit some and to marginalize and disenfranchise others. And then critical theory is also a pushback on traditional theory in this regard. Traditional theory wants to merely describe society and the world as it is. Critical theory is a pushback against that. Max Horkheimer wrote a paper about traditional theory and critical theory in the 1930s, where he is challenging traditional theory as being flawed by only describing society as it is. His argument is that a theory ought to, and critical theory does, not only describe society as it is, but it also prescribes a better vision for how society ought to be. And part of that project is an activist project that seeks to emancipate and empower those groups that have been disenfranchised and marginalized. So our audience needs to really take away that critical theory is about addressing power in our social systems, and then also providing a way of emancipation and empowerment for those groups who have been marginalized and disenfranchised by those who are in power.
Yes, it's not just the theory. It's one that promotes action or revolution, wouldn't you say, Dr. Chevney?
Yeah, absolutely. So the critical theorists, drawing on the Marxist tradition, do believe that we need massive social transformation to achieve their goals. And so I mentioned those four ideas. The first idea is the social binary, this idea that society is divided into oppressor groups and oppressed groups along lines of race, class, gender, sexuality, physical ability, nationality, and a host of other identity markers. And that we're all trapped in these systems that are unjust. What they believe is that some groups have what's called hegemonic power. The second idea, some groups have imposed their values and their norms on culture in a way that excludes certain people and minimizes their power. And then how do we escape? And all of us are sort of conditioned to believe these lies, the patriarchy, of white supremacy, of heterosexism. So we're all conditioned to view those norms and values as natural and objective and neutral. But in reality, they're just ways that the ruling class justifies their own power. So we see through those lies via lived experience. This is the third idea, that if you're part of an oppressed group, you have special insight into reality, into racism, sexism, heterosexism. And then finally, you can use your insight to change society for the better. So their end goal is social justice, which they define as overturning the systems and structures which perpetuate the social binary. So they look forward to a promised land of diversity and equity and inclusion, where there are no more oppressors and no more oppressed, where we all share power. And they, of course, they do see that as a revolutionary project.
Yes. Now, you both talked about a lot of its roots going back to cultural Marxism. So, Dr. Sori, just give us a brief history on the origins and the development of critical theory.
Well, it would be fair to think of Karl Marx as the first critical theorist. And so Marxism is problematizing and challenging our economic arrangements. And it is problematizing and challenging class. And those who are out of power because of issues relative to class and issues relative to the labor market and labor movement and means of production, those people who are outside of power need to be brought into power. Well, the Frankfurt School in the 1920s and 30s, a school of social science and research, and a number of scholars were domiciled to that school in Frankfurt, Germany. Their campaign was a pushback on Marxism to some extent, and then an amendment and extension of Marxism. So in many ways, the Frankfurt School thought that Marx had failed and was short-sighted in terms of only thinking about class or primarily thinking about class. And so the scholars in the Frankfurt School began to see that, well, power is also manifested in our customs, our norms, our traditions that are prominent in society. And those very places of power and the reification of certain traditions and customs and norms was leaving some outside of power. So they had an expansion of thinking about power now manifested in various cultural stakeholders and institutions, like the education industry, for instance, or the medical industry, or the entertainment industry. And the enterprise of critical social theory, historic critical theory, really was part of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, and 60s. That institute ended up being affected by Nazism. And so some of those scholars moved to the U.S. for a period of time. And you see a number of scholars associated with the Frankfurt School. Jürgen Habermas was a prominent one in the second half of that school. But we have people like Eric from people like Max Horkheimer, Theodore Adorno, Herbert Marcuse. There was a number of scholars associated. Well, today we have critical social theory, which is an umbrella term for a number of critical social theories, like critical race theory, postcolonialism, critical pedagogy, and so forth, queer theory, feminist theory. And each of those critical social theories is assessing power along a certain axis, as Neil mentioned. So queer theory is concerned about how power is being manifested relative to gender and sexuality. Critical pedagogy is interested in terms of how power is manifested in the educational system and then also relative to capitalism. Postcolonialism is concerned about imperialism and colonization of indigenous groups by foreign powers. Critical race theory is concerned about a number of issues, including race, how power is manifested relative to race. And so these critical social theories are really what is prominent in the academy today and for the last 20 to 30 years. When it comes to critical social justice and anti-racism ideology, those are two perspectives that are really downstream from critical social theory today and connected to critical social theory, but then they have some of their own features as well. So that's kind of the history of critical social theory over the last 140 years.
Yeah, the way I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Marx saw the struggle between the oppressors and the oppressed in terms of economics. And he thought there was going to be a revolution of Marxism throughout the world, and that didn't happen. And that seems to have shifted now from oppressed and oppressor being defined as economics or class warfare to more as now race or gender. Is that the shift that we've seen, Dr. Shenvey?
That's right. And actually, there's more than just that. People often just say, well, isn't it just Marxism? And it's related to Marxism, but it's not identical. So one big difference is that Marx thought that a culture was largely a product of economics. So religion, values, morality. Marx thought all of those were sort of almost, they were called the superstructure. They were just outworkings of the economic relationships in the culture. So if you wanted to change the culture, you wanted to change the values, the morality, you just had to change who controlled the factories, basically. Well, later critical theorists almost inverted that. They said, actually, the person who really has power is the one who controls the ideas of society. This is how they explain the fact there wasn't Marxist revolutions in these countries. You know, we waited 50, 60 years. Where are all the Marxist revolutions? There weren't any. So they had explained that, and they explained it by saying that the proletariat, the workers, had what they called a false consciousness, and that they were deceived into thinking that capitalism was good and fair and just. So if you really want to achieve a utopia, you have to fix the consciousness of the workers. You have to give them a class consciousness and then extend it to that, to say women through feminism, to the gay community through gay liberation movements, to people of color through critical race theory. The idea always is that the ruling class has imposed their values on the subordinate groups, the oppressed groups, that oftentimes the oppressed people don't even know they're oppressed. So you have to raise their consciousness so they can achieve what's called a critical consciousness or a liberatory consciousness. Colloquially, they can get woke. They can begin to see themselves as oppressed, to recognize all these systems that are keeping them down, and then to throw off those shackles. So to our first approximation, you can say this is a Marxism applied to various axes. That's very simplistic. And in our book, we really expand on how is this similar to, but also different from, classical Marxism.
Yeah. Now, Pat, when you understand critical theory, you kind of see it everywhere now. And even in popular culture, you see a lot of these terms being thrown out here. This news media has gone woke. This university or school has gone woke and all this. How did these theories arise and become so popular in our culture today, especially here in the West?
Well, that's a good question. The academy ultimately at a certain point will spill over into society and to culture on the ground. So that tends to happen anyway, that what's in the academy over time will manifest itself in the streets, in our bars, in our break rooms, in our workplaces, around our kitchen table at a certain point. Now, there's certain things that have helped accentuate this, I think. We certainly have a resurgence of identity politics over the last 10 to 15 years, We've also seen some civil unrest that's been pretty pronounced with Trayvon Martin, for instance, with George Floyd, and a number of African-Americans who have been killed and been really put forward in the news. And so this civil unrest that has taken place has also accentuated these perspectives. I would also say Trump and the reality of Trump and the polarization of Trump and the way Trump has been contextualized in society, this has also brought these issues to the forefront. And I think all of these things together provide kind of an elixir in a way for woke perspective, which is really just truncated forms of critical social theory, woke perspective. And again, words are on the move. That word woke has a history. It doesn't, how it's commonly being defined today is different than it was historically. You know, words are not captives to a certain era. So we want to keep that in mind. But the woke perspective that I think, Patrick, that you're talking about, this is downstream from these perspectives of critical social theory that we just mentioned. And all of this combination of these various factors that I mentioned has made us ripe for dealing with identity politics in a pronounced way. And in addition to the final thing that I would say, our popular culture is really captive to social mediated environments. Our social media has such a grip on consumers and persons and human beings. And so this means that news is traveling fast. Lots of things are being recorded or being able to be shown in our mediated environments. And then we have platforms like Twitter and TikTok, where, and other social mediated formats, where these ideas, this percolation of these identity politics, can get to people quickly and get to youth quickly and get to our screens quickly. And therefore, we're being conditioned with all this ideas percolating around woke perspective because of the bombardment that we're getting it from our screens due to the explosion of social media platforms over the last decade.
Yes, you know, and in your book, but also I've experienced this walking around on the university campuses and things, that it's not only the Christians who are concerned, but also many atheists are now showing concern about wokeness or critical theory. Neil, tell us why this is.
Well, one of the things that's very clear in the literature is that critical theorists, especially critical race theorists, reject classical liberalism. That is, they reject the idea that there are neutral values, that we can have a value-free public square. They reject things like, believe it or not, rights discourse, like human rights discourse. Critical race theorists question that. They view human rights discourse as a way for the privileged to keep their power. And a lot of atheists, you share our, as Christians, share our belief that no, human rights are a good thing. They exist. Now, they can't really ground them. We would say that God is the one who secures our human rights, and our founder recognized that. But they're seeing an assault on things like free speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of association, and they would be concerned as we are about that. So, you know, our book, we had four secular slash atheist scholars endorse our book, even though it's written from a very overtly Christian perspective, because they simply thought it was a valuable commentary on analysis of critical theory in our culture. So I think there is room for Christians and atheists to be kind of co-belligerents, pushing back against this ultimately false and dangerous ideology.
Yes, from the way I understand it, everyone falls into two groups, oppressed and oppressors. And the way I understand it, which is determined by race, gender, sexuality, and other factors. And if you are part of the oppressor camp, it's only the oppressed who know truth and reality. And so if you're part of the oppressor, you're immediately dismissed as someone that really can't know reality or the truth. You know, did I get that right?
Yes, generally speaking, yes, you get that right. So this goes to a phenomenon called standpoint epistemology, that your social location and standpoint gives you insight in terms of how you know what is true and how you know what is accurate. And Paulo Freire, for instance, in Pedagogy of the Oppressed, mentions that it is the oppressed that needs to not only that they must, the oppressed must not only free themselves, but also be the one to free their oppressor, that the oppressor is blinded by their privilege. The oppressor has come to believe that their way of life is normal, right, even maybe God ordained, or just customary, or the standard that every other group needs to come up to. And since that's the case, then they have a harder time recognizing how their privilege is actually operative in society, leading to the disenfranchisement of others. The oppressed are viewed as just seeing the unequal realities in our society as being the fault of the oppressed and having nothing to do with themselves or the social systems that are in place and the cultural dynamics that are in place that are leading to oppression. The oppressor views themselves as being normative and the standard. Therefore, now they are blind to how that reality is being worked out in society. So it is the oppressed who not only sees their condition for what it is themselves, but then also looks at the oppressor and sees the flaws in the perspective and the thinking and so forth. And that standpoint of being oppressed, according to standpoint epistemology and critical social theory, now gives an enlightened perspective, special insight in terms of social analysis in general, and then whatever oppression is in play. So if you're a woman and you're dealing with issues of sexism, then you're going to be able to see that and understand that better than a man. If you are Black and you are seeing how racism is being manifested and worked out in American society, you have better insight into that social analysis around race than someone who is white. Now, this is just made up. This is not necessarily true. Now, we don't deny that there can be some insight that if you have a particular lived experience, that you have some insight around that experience. And if someone else has none of that lived experience and none of those perspectives in their life, well, obviously there can be some insight that is given by the one who has had that lived experience. But critical social theory really goes way beyond what that common sense understanding is and actually ascribes special insight to those who are quote unquote oppressed in terms of social analysis and social understanding. And this has an interesting way, Patrick, of, and from an intersectional standpoint, taking those people who are part of that oppressed perspective along different axes of power, and now they're given cultural capital and cultural power to speak into certain areas of our society. And those who are in that oppressor class are asked to sit down, stop talking, and not contribute, because they're stunted in how they are assessing and discerning things. And so there's been a flipping of the switch, so to speak, in terms of how now cultural capital is often given to people who are part of that oppressed class and now given carte blanche to lead DEI training, to help lead corporations and organizations on how to think about policy, how our government should be thinking about laws and our criminal justice system. This is the zeitgeist of our times.
Yes. And Dr. Shenvey, you talk about oppressed and oppressors and how there are man-made structures, or you call them hegemonic structures, that keep the oppressors in their positions of power and the oppressed oppressed. So tell us about, I mean, what are these hegemonic structures and what is their answer to the problem of the oppressed and the oppressor?
Right. So this is where critical theory today especially diverges from Marx. So Marx thought these structures were mainly economic. So it's who controls the means of production, who owns the factories, basically. That's what determines who's the oppressor and who's the oppressed. And that was really responsible for oppression, is the economics and class. Whereas today, contemporary critical theorists focus much more on who has the control of ideas. So whose ideas are taken as normal, objective, neutral, even God-ordained. So for example, critical theorists believe we live in a patriarchy. Why? They would say because our natural intuition is actually filled full of male-centered ideas.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran. Wake up.